We've been talking with Mary Capps, part of our ongoing investigation into the minds of evil. In this case, not her mind, but rather the man that she used to work for, the BTK killer. That was her boss in Park City, Kansas, a man who had left clues around like breadcrumbs, but nobody had picked up on them. Mary herself said that she never would have suspected that he was even capable of being the BTK killer. However, she had lots of evil and very unnerving experiences with him as he continued to sort of wreak havoc in her life. We were talking about the last week or so of when they worked together. In this case, Mary had been denied a raise by the city of Park City based on the recommendations of her boss, Dennis Rader, the BTK killer, and how he had been kind of, overjoyed, Mary, would be a good way to describe how he felt when he heard that you had resigned.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. He was pretty happy that day.
Who had he told about that? How do you know what his feelings were about your resignation?
Well, when I gave him, Jack, and Carol Jones, the city clerk, a copy of my resignation, Dennis was in a terrific mood. It was completely out of character for him. And he called me into his office, and he was making it clear what my duties would be for the last 2 weeks. And he's just real happy about that. It was only the next day that I found out that when he found out that Jack had talked me out of quitting and I had written a letter rescinding that, he and Jack really went at it. I guess they had an argument about it, you know, and that's only hearsay to me that that they had that argument. I believe it.
Right. This is Jack being his superior in the correct Park City structure of things. So that the BTK killer goes from being overjoyed that you're finally leaving because you had stood up to him. You weren't scared of him. You had made it very clear that you didn't enjoy working with him. And he had even intimidated you at one point or several points where you even felt like maybe you might have been his next victim now that you look back on it. Although that would have been out of character in one sense because the BTK killer always went for people that didn't have any continuity to his life, right? He was kind of a random guy. He didn't take victims of women that he knew, did he?
Yes, the one in 1985.
Oh, I guess you're right. Yeah, I guess that's right.
A few doors down from him, talked to her all the time. When he would be out walking his dog or going down the street, she'd be working in her yard or he'd be working in his yard. Yeah, as a neighbor.
Yeah, but yeah. It would have been inconsistent. It would have been hard for him to have done, to have murdered you, at least in the office, because then there's no way he would have definitely been exposed.
In the office? No, I don't think he would have. I think that I pushed his buttons enough that day that incident happened with him shutting the door. I think I triggered that part of his dark personality at that point in time. I mean, he was already acting on a lot of weird stuff. You know, he's taunting the police again and the public, you know, causing terror and feeding off of that.
Right.
And at that time that we had that argument in the office, I think I triggered it.
Yeah, maybe he just wanted to tell you how powerful he really was. Maybe in his heart he was itching to tell you who he was, how he...
That's caused me some nightmares, I'll tell you.
I bet. So they talk you out of it, you go to work, then suddenly you bump into your superiors who tell you, go home, you're on paid leave, you're the only one being sent home, but there's a federal investigation.
Right.
And that's when you found out that that your boss had been the BTK killer?
Not that day, no. I went home, I hired an attorney, I sat inside my locked home. I live by myself, locked inside there thinking, oh my gosh, they're going to come. They're going to handcuff me. I couldn't imagine what it could have been that I had done. Although there was speculation, it's like, you know, just in December of 2004, just a few, you know, 2 months before that, another person had been taken in for a person of interest for the BTK killer and found to be innocent. You know, and so, you know, there was speculation that somebody was being questioned on BTK, but my mind was focused on the fact that I was the only person being sent home, and it was a federal investigation. It was the next morning with the rest of the world that I found out that the person that I had complained about, the person that I had to deal with as evil, hateful, bullying was the same person that everybody ignored me on, that he was the person that was capable of murdering people. Can you imagine how that can make you feel? To be complaining about somebody all the time and everybody just saying, oh, it's just Dennis. Well, no, just Dennis kills people.
I don't know how you didn't resist the temptation to run up and down the hallway and say, I told you so, I told you so, I told you so.
I never went back to work.
Never?
Never. I never went back.
Did they ever
put that uniform back on and work for a city that does not back their employees or protect them and provide a place that is free of harassment?
Did you ever go to your superiors or anybody else and just, or did they ever contact you and apologize for the fact that?
I've never been apologized to. The day right after they announced that he had been arrested and charged, I get a phone call from Jack. Mary, you need to hide. The media is looking for you because you're a woman and you worked for Dennis. Not, hey, I'm sorry. Is there anything we could do for you? Nothing.
Right.
Just do us a favor and keep your mouth shut, Mary.
Right.
Well, I went into hiding, changed my phone number, and I stayed in hiding for about 17 months. Never got another job. I had no income.
Hmm. I can't imagine what that's been like for you.
It was a nightmare.
Well, I'm glad at least that part of it is over and that you can rebuild from here, such as it is, although writing the book, I hope, also not only brings you some financial reward, but also allows you to help process what you've been through working for the BT killer. The book is My Boss Was the BTK Killer, Mary Capps. Thank you so much for telling us your story, and I really would be expecting at some point to see that on the small screen, if not the big screen. So who would you like to play you in the Mary Capps story?
I've not even given that any thought.
Oh, come on, pick well. Come on.
I don't know. Gosh, I don't know.
Heather Locklear. When I go for...
No, she's a little, I don't know. She's a little probably too pretty.
Well, that's the best thing about fiction. You could take somebody like that, rewrite the story slightly, and you're Heather Locklear. If you ever do a part with an interview, I want to be played by Gilbert Gottfried, okay?
So
if you could work on that.
I have to pick Susan Sarandon.
Susan Sarandon, excellent choice. All right, Well, terrific, and I wish you the best of luck. Thank you, Mary Capps.
Well, thank you.
And after exploring the depths of evil, I think this is a good time for us to switch directions and explore the dimensions of the blessed next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. William Henry is an investigative mythologist as well as an author and a speaker and a pretty deep thinker. Thanks for jumping on the show tonight, William Henry.
Hi, Ian. How you doing?
Good. And you're also, are we talking to you from Nashville tonight?
Yes, I'm in Nashville. Yes. Mm-hmm.
I used to live in Nashville.
That's what I heard. You were you partnered up with somebody on WKDF here.
Did you know him? Did you know the Duke by any chance?
Of course. Yeah, I moved here to Nashville in 1981, 82, and I do remember the Duke. Sure.
He's the best. And in fact, I just got an email from my friend Demetria Kalodimos the other day.
I know Demetria.
Asking about our family after the 35W bridge collapse, and so I went to college with DK. So,
yeah, and her lovely sister.
Yeah, you know Thalia.
Yes,
the wild one. So, so William Henry, I'm fascinated by some of the work you've been doing. And in fact, I got to know a lot of more about you this week after watching your DVDs and having a chance to sit down with your book, and we'll talk about all of those things. But let me just say, I was looking at one of your DVDs shortly after I'd been doing some work on the covering of the 35W bridge collapse here in the Twin Cities, which has been getting a lot of coverage.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking about them a little bit about the symbolism of bridges. And you don't have to reflect on this at all, and it doesn't really have anything necessarily to do with your work. But I know you often look at symbols and stuff, and I've been really playing with that idea of why it is that this bridge has captured our imaginations so much, not just because of the loss of life, but I think there's something about the idea about crossing over things and how vulnerable we feel when we're in transition from terra firma over here, over something like a river, till we get to the other side. And there's just, you know, so many news stories about people who have been really having to seek help even at the thought of crossing over the bridges that they had normally taken for granted in their life. And I don't know, I saw deep symbolism in that.
Oh, absolutely. You know, in fact, everywhere I've been here the past few days in Nashville, and people are talking about the bridge. And so you're right, it's resonating at a very deep level with people. And I think that's a very interesting observation, that it has to do with this idea that we feel like we live our lives on a solid foundation, but sometimes that's challenged, and then we're forced to or compelled to reexamine certain things. And unfortunately for the folks crossing that bridge, it was an abrupt reexamination, unfortunately, but it happens. And so I always look for the higher benefit. I mean, you have situations that emerge like that, and so it's up to the rest of us to kind of take a look at it, attach some personal meaning to it, and learn something hopefully positive from it.
The personal meaning I attach to it is that bridges are perhaps more than we consciously think about them, but at some point, bridges are an act of faith.
Mm-hmm.
You think we think it's all going to be fine when we get to the other side, and you can look out on the other side. You can see, you know, frequently you're crossing a bridge, all you can see is air. All you can see is, you can't really see the support that exists underneath it. And I find that symbolic of so many of the transitions in our lives too. We can look to our left and look to our right. We can see other people on the journey with us, mm-hmm. but we can't see what's holding us all up.
Well said.
And then when it's not there, that's when we suddenly recognize the vulnerability of all of those crossings and all of those journeys. I don't know. That was just something I was musing about while I was reading your book, too. And that's why I think it may be a good tie-in to talk about your various missions and the journeys you've been on. For example, you just got back from France?
I did. I had taken a tour group with me over to some of the hot spots there, the energy centers, including Rennes-le-Château and a couple of Templar sites around Paris, various cathedrals. And then I hopped over to Switzerland and went to the particle accelerator at CERN, and then visited another small village called Sion, Switzerland, where some interesting mysteries are found.
I don't know about that. Tell me about that.
Well, there's this incredible image that I've used in my books for over 10 years. It shows Joshua and Caleb, these two Old Testament figures, having stolen this oversized cluster of grapes from the Anunnaki at their stronghold at a place called Eshcol. They delivered this cluster of grapes to the crucifixion. And it's very strange, because this otherworldly cluster of grapes has these really weird connections to the possibility that the Anunnaki were utilizing space bridges or portals or stargates at this place, and that this oversized cluster of grapes might have symbolized some kind of exotic substance that Joshua and Caleb stole that is relative to these portals. And at this one church, this small church in Sion, Switzerland, is where you find them delivering this exotic substance to the crucifixion. And I've never seen it anywhere else, and I've been very puzzled by it for years. So I finally got a chance to visit Sion and see see this woodcut for myself, and it was really spectacular.
Any thought on whether or not it is a symbolic representation of the metaphor that's used in the New Testament, that Gentiles have been grafted onto the vine of the chosen people? They've been grafted onto the pre-existing vine through the cross.
Well, that's definitely one level of interpretation on it. Another would be that the vine is symbolic of the way to heaven. It's referred to as the vine of the soul sometimes. Interestingly, the cluster of grapes is likened by astrophysicists. They look at the center of our Milky Way galaxy and say, hey, that looks like a cluster of grapes too. So there might even be this other cosmic connection to it as well. So, I mean, there's so many different interpretations, and that's what to me makes it such a remarkable image.
Well, and it's definitely the more cosmic interpretations which take your work into these different dimensions, the dimension of the blessed just being one of them. We'll talk more about that. And let me go back a little bit to kind of where we started. How did you get to become an investigative mythologist. Who else is out there that does that sort of work? And I mean, is that something you could actually like study for at a university? Do they? Because I know you teach at universities, some of you lecture at universities. Does anybody actually offer a degree in that?
Well, there's you can get degrees, master's and PhDs in mythology from like Pacifica University, but I'm kind of trailblazing in what I'm doing. And it's funny because I get emails all the time, how do I become an investigative mythologist? And people see the value in looking at the symbols that we use in our present culture and linking them to past ideas and historical events to see if, in fact, we are repeating history, or if we are in the midst of some kind of an archetypal drama, and that by following the symbols that are involved, we can move our way through that archetypal drama. So that's basically what I look for, is what are the symbols that are being used at a place, what are the meaning behind those symbols, and what are we to attach to the current event or the situation that's utilizing those symbols.
Well, then, is that the difference between an investigative mythologist and a mythology investigator?
Well, the other thing is that scholars, as you probably know, just abhor the idea of connecting dots. That is, it's virtually written in stone that you can't connect dots. And that's one of the liberties that I have as an investigative mythologist, is it's okay to connect dots, to connect seemingly unconnected concepts or ideas, and to look to integrate rather than to separate. So that's primarily what I'm all about, is looking for dots that are kind of laying about or haven't previously been connected, and find ways that we can connect them. And in so doing, it helps to kind of wire up the global consciousness, the divine mind, if you will, of humankind, and opens up new avenues of possibility.
Well, let me push back a little bit on that then, say investigative mythologist or mythology investigator. If you're just a mythology investigator, then you might investigate where dots have been previously drawn. But as an investigative mythologist, would it be fair to say that you are actively engaged in myth creation or exploration, in connecting dots that may never have been connected before?
Yeah, sure. That's absolutely fair to say. I mean, and now is such an incredible time to be doing this kind of research, because unlike previous famous mythologists such as Joseph Campbell, he died just about the time the personal computer was being introduced, and he readily apprehended that, hey, this is a revolutionary technology. This is going to change everything. And today, it's kind of like, if you're investigating mythology, you're finding just nuggets of gold all over the place, and new ideas that are coming forward, and connections to be made.
I want to get into more of the specifics of Rennes Le Chateau here too, because I know you'd mentioned the other place, but did you have a particular goal in your pursuit of the visit to Rennes Le Chateau in France?
Yeah, this was the fifth time I had been to Rennes Le Chateau, which of course is kind of the ground zero for the parallel Christian mysteries, the what are referred to as the secrets, or referred to by Henry Lincoln as the center of the religion of Jesus and Mary Magdalene, as opposed to the descriptive religion about them. It's thought that they may have lived there, that they deposited certain sacred texts or secrets. And my mission in going to Rennes Le Chateau this time was to seek additional evidence for a lost gospel that the Cathars referred to as the Book of Love, which was believed to be a collection of symbols that were delivered to Jesus by Jesus to John the Divine, and contain the original primitive Christian revelation, as it's called, which is really a group of scientific symbols that were derived from ancient Egypt, from Iran, from Iraq, from India, and all came together in a collection of symbols. And the ultimate aim of this gospel of love, or book of love, was to transfigure or transform ordinary individuals into immortal beings of light.
All right. Well, then I'll ask you about your pursuit of that, and also a particular story that's in the news today about the implications of Rennes Le Chateau. Perhaps you heard about it. Maybe you didn't. Next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. William Henry was last on, I think, earlier this spring with George Norrie. That's what George told me the other night when I was on with him, and look forward to getting back to our conversation, both about what he found at Rennes Le Chateau in pursuit of a lost biblical text, perhaps, but also the story that, I don't know, everybody got a chance to hear about because of the bridge collapse, that this massive story of the 35W bridge collapsing during, rush hour traffic here in the Twin Cities. It kind of eclipsed a lot of news stories for about 36 hours. This was one of them. Maybe you heard, maybe you didn't. I'd like to hear what William Henry has to say about the latest research into the Last Supper painting next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. William Henry, investigative mythologist. Did you happen to catch the story? It was carried by like the BBC. I saw it on a link. I can't remember what news site it was, but it was about the latest research in a new book that's coming up about the Last Supper.
Was that, I saw that image on the Coast site the other morning, and just kind of fleetingly looked at it. It looks like the guy had done some clever manipulation, some mirror work on it or symmetry work on it. I thought it was kind of interesting. I'm not, sure that it's, anything that I'm going to follow up on, but I thought it was intriguing anyway.
Well, it was linked on the coasttocoastam.com site for about 24 hours, but it was the kind of thing that maybe if it had come out when the DVD for the Da Vinci Code or the book or the movie or something else had been
right
out, it would have gotten a lot more play. But it was intriguing, this person doing this work, as you mentioned, doing mirror imaging of and looking at, I guess, like X-rays of the canvas or something like that for the Last Supper. And it's so, what appears to be an image of Mary Magdalene that doesn't appear to the naked eye, but is there, of her holding a baby. And I don't know what to make of it, except that you said you were investigating that alternative perception of that at Rennes Le Chateau, and I thought that's an interesting tie-in this week.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I revisited a prison in Dom, France, which is nearby Rennes Le Chateau, where Templar nobles or initiates were imprisoned after the arrest of their Grand Master, Jacques de Molay, in 1307. And this prison is covered with some of the most amazing graffiti you've ever seen. I mean, these guys viewed themselves as the last Templars. They believed they were it. And so they actually used their rotten teeth that had rotted out of their mouth, to etch their secret teachings on the walls of this prison for perpetuity. One of the key images there is of a pregnant Mary Magdalene at the crucifixion holding a magic wand or rod in her hand. And so that is definitely a key belief of those who uphold this parallel tradition, that Jesus and Mary Magdalene were married, that there was a secret teaching that has been suppressed, and that by recovering that secret teaching, presumably we'll be able to recover ultimate secrets about ourselves.
Well, and I like that idea that that wand piece that you refer to in one of your DVDs at great length, and you show pictures of, I assume something like that's also on your website, because that is something that, it does seem very Egyptian. It seems sort of classical, but in the first couple of centuries of Christian iconography, Jesus is seen performing particular miracles holding a wand.
Right.
And I guess it never really occurred to me. It looked like a staff or a stick, but I didn't really think of it as a wand. But certainly the way it's portrayed, the magic appears to be happening at the end of the stick.
Absolutely. And in one particular image that's actually in the Vatican Museum, Jesus is kind of conking Lazarus in the cave right on his crown chakra, right on the third eye, as if to say, hey, wake up, wake up. And in that same depiction, you can almost view him as like a symphony conductor. I mean, some people take the Holy Grail to be a tuner, a vibration, including me. And so if you think of the Grail as a song grail, then he is a conductor of this life force energy, this key of life, as the ancient Egyptians called it. And what he's doing is using this this rod or wand as a conductive force, a baton, if you will, to awaken Lazarus, rather, just like the ancient Egyptian god of divine magic Thoth raised Osiris using a similar ankh or key of life. It's really incredible to think that maybe they were drawing upon not just an ancient Egyptian belief system, but also a profound spiritual technology that has been lost. And it's really funny, isn't it, Ian, the way Harry Potter has suddenly come on so strong on our planet in the past 10 years, and his key icon or image is that magic wand.
Well, yeah, no, I mean, I don't know that the idea of the magic wand or Harry Potter has ever really left our popular psyche. I think it's part of, I mean, because just as you said, whether it's Harry Potter or whether it's a magician with a top hat and a rabbit, mm-hmm. I mean, wands are always sort of there. I mean, hardly a kid ever in the history of kiddom grew up without picking up a stick off the ground and pretending it was a magic wand,
right,
long before the popularity of Harry Potter. What intrigued me about the work you did was that you were drawing these direct comparisons to this ancient Egyptian imagery of a wand, and almost sort of like line for line in some of these early Christian portrayals and in these hieroglyphic images, you can see somebody using that same stick in the exact same way that Jesus is shown to be using it, which speaks to, it seems to me, the mystery cults.
Right.
And that these mystery cults that had sort of appropriated the Jesus story into their pre-existing cult, just simply transferred a lot of the image or the visual imagery of the Egyptian gods and goddesses to this new, you know, Christian paradigm.
Well, they didn't know what to do. There was a prohibition against depicting the way, which is what Christ was thought of. You couldn't show, that's idolatry to show a person. And so admittedly, for several centuries, was he clean-shaven? Did he have short hair? Did he have long hair? Did he have a beard? All of these kinds of things. Did he have a magic wand? I kind of take the opposite view, though, Ian. I think that what happened is you're not dealing with cults, mystery cults. You're dealing with mystery schools.
Sure.
There's a big difference.
Sure. No, I would go along with schools. Okay, cults is just what they're called typically. But, yeah, the mystery schools.
And
okay.
They're drawing upon this ancient imagery and this ancient knowledge. And what happened is it appears is that when the Jesus story is being written, they edit. They selectively edit some of perhaps the original revelation out. And that's kind of what my research is beginning to focus on is, okay, if they were this incredible mystery school who had access to the Library of Alexandria and the working temples of Egypt, of Iran and Iraq and of India, what was it that they were looking for? And what I've been learning is that what they were looking for was the secret of what is referred to in the Bible as metamorphosis, transfiguration. They seem to know that this human body is sort of in a pupil form, and that our ultimate existence is going to be in more of a butterfly-type form, where we're ascended beings of light, free to travel the galaxy. And they left books of symbols that will enable us to more deeply absorb that teaching within our being so that we can, in fact, become these transfigured or metamorphosed beings.
When I use the term cult, of course, I just mean it in a sort of non-pejorative form as a subset, a subgroup, not the common. And
like
these
Heaven's Gate cult or something, right?
Yeah. Well, but Heaven's Gate cult has that negative image.
Oh,
I mean,
absolutely.
Heaven's, right. I really just sort of mean it in the sense that it is a group that had special, what they thought of as special insight, and that you had to be initiated into it, which is where I find that particularly, I thought the imagery was compelling. But let me also then go back to, again, Rennes Le Chateau. What did you find? I know what you went looking for there. You were talking about this gospel of love, but what did you find when you went there?
Well, I found actually that Rennes Le Chateau is presently embroiled in a real heated kind of exchange between researchers like Henry Lincoln and the mayor, who is presently defacing much of the mystery tradition at Rennes Le Chateau. The backstory here is that this priest, Baron J. Saunier, at the turn of the 20th century, discovered some cache of perhaps parchments or documents of inestimable value, of perhaps esoteric significance. Perhaps it was information relative to a holy bloodline. Either way, he left clues to this discovery in the Church of Mary Magdalene at Rennes-le-Château, including one particular image I'm fond of, and that is that on January 17th, he set it up so that the sun would shine through a stained glass window, which happened to be of Jesus raising Lazarus from the dead. And on that day, as the sun shone through that glass, it projected on the opposite wall the image of a cluster of what are referred to as blue apples, blue orbs. The mayor has decided that that's not appropriate, so he's actually covered up that window, and that phenomena no longer happens at Rennes-le-Château. And so when I got there, I was just really shocked at the level of really just kind of just the way this mayor is trashing this place. And most of it is in response to the incredible popularity that Rennes-le-Château has experienced due to the Da Vinci Code.
Well, what's the mayor's authority over it? Is the land in public domain?
The mayors in France have almost virtually a dictatorial power over their towns and villages. He can do just about anything he wants. So it's an elected position, but once in office, he can do just about anything he wants.
Yeah, but who owns Rennes-le-Château? Is there not a public trust that's set up away from that, or is it still owned theoretically by the church? I mean, whose property? Who holds the paper?
Well, there are individuals that own pieces of land on top of Rennes-le-Château. It's a small village, and there's probably 20, 30 landowners there.
I would think some of them would have a right to say whether the mayor could put up a could block a window like that.
Apparently not. And so what's happening now is that Henry Lincoln, who, of course, wrote the book Holy Blood, Holy Grail, and several other authors are pushing back, trying to preserve the legacy of Rennes-le-Château because they do consider it such a hotbed of this imagery and symbolism.
I like Rennes-le-Château, and I've enjoyed taking a tour myself over of these Da Vinci Code sites and spending some time on the subject. But I had my suspicions about that priest, and I saw one, I think, fairly well-documented story that ascribes his sudden cache of wealth that came to him as a result of running ads in foreign newspapers, ads that copies of which still existed, in which he was promising to pray for people for money, which was a common priestly function at the time. You send him a small pittance and they would, you know, add him onto a prayer list, but that he literally did it in terms of, I mean, where he would have had to have been praying 24 hours a day for like 150 years to actually get to all the names of all the people that had sent him money to put him on the prayer list, that he was essentially kind of running a scam out of the back door, and that's where he found this great wealth. And it's also why he couldn't speak of it, because it would have been greatly frowned upon by his church superiors. And so he was perfectly willing to allow that money mystery to remain that way for fear of being exposed. Where are you with that?
There's so many theories about that, and I prefer to spend my time looking at what are the clues that he actually left.
And I think that is different. I think that he could easily have taken the money that he got from this other thing and used it on the Church of Magdalene without a doubt. Mm-hmm. I think that seems like a very reasonable scenario. He had all this money, he had to do something with it.
Right, exactly. And so here he is going about leaving these bizarre clues in this church to hint that there's some kind of a mystery here. I mean, there's some of the latest thinking is that he was paid off by the Habsburg dynasty, that in fact he had found some kind of genealogy of the Habsburgs. It's also thought that he found some kind of a lost gospel as well, and my sense would be that what he might have actually discovered was an early copy of the Gospel of Thomas. And what they cite as evidence that it was the Habsburgs is that Otto von Habsburg is presently fast-tracked for sainthood by the Catholic Church, and I can't think of anything that Otto von Habsburg did that would warrant him becoming a saint. But the current thinking is that, well, what he did is he got these documents from Saunier and turned them over to the church and did them a tremendous favor by locking up whatever it was that he had found in Rennes-le-Château.
Well, that I hadn't heard. I the Gospel of Thomas piece is interesting. I hadn't heard that that was the book either. But
you know, the basis for that, Ian, is that in the Church of Mary Magdalene, you have at beside the altar, you have statues of what is purported to be, as you know, Joseph and Mary holding twin children in their hands. And what they say at Rennes-le-Château is that that's not Joseph and Mary, that's Jesus and Mary holding their twin children. And of course, the twin idea is all wrapped up in the Gospel of Thomas idea with the notion that, that Thomas was Jesus's twin brother. And, you know, of course, the church despises it. There's no virgin birth. There's no crucifixion in it. And so those are the first two strikes. But the third strike is the first line of the gospel says that if you can interpret these lines, you'll live forever.
Right.
So it's an alchemical gospel.
Yeah, but there's also no narrative at all in the Gospel of Thomas. So it's not that it lacks it's not like there's any gaps in the story. There's no story. It's just
right.
A collection of quotes.
Exactly.
And I dig the Gospel of Thomas in a big way, and I'm friendly with one of the leading scholars on it. And I find that the material that it's in it is really very esoteric and speaks directly to what you write about, which is to do the kind of table order reshifting all the time that appear in the story of Jesus. We have him always, you know, challenging power. And so, I mean, I think that's what the Gospel of Thomas keeps doing. It keeps pushing you to keep challenging power in this really intriguing way. So in this work, though, that you've been doing in this research, did you find anything in the Rennes-le-Château visit which then endorsed some of these beliefs you've been working with as an investigative mythologist about the scientific aspects of belief, or the history that you see there of religion as a way of masking or unlocking these psychic or physical dimensions?
I did, Ian, in the form of a person that knew Antonin Gadol, who's considered, he's called the Cathar Pope. The Cathars were referred to as the Pure Ones. They lived nearby Rennes-le-Château, and it is they who claimed that they possessed this secret gospel written in symbols. And as a consequence of that, I was put onto a book called On the Path to the Holy Grail by Gadol. And it was very helpful to me because I had already had a partial list of some of what are called, again, the primitive Christian symbols, the early first century AD symbols that were collected by these disciples and presumably made their way into France. These symbols included such things as the palm and the crown, traditional symbols, the vine, the tree of life, the dove of the Holy Spirit. But the one thing that I learned in this book that is, again, considered to be one of the major authorities on the lost Cathar gospel, the Book of Love, it's said that one of the key symbols of this of the Book of Love, what is referred to as the light ship of Isis and the column of glory or the channel of light. And this was really important to me because I've been making this Egyptian connection. And when you look at the light ship of Isis in Egyptian iconography, it's portrayed exactly the way modern science portrays a wormhole. And then you have the Cathars coming in and connecting this light ship of Isis with something they called the column of glory or the channel of light, which is portrayed in Cathar artwork as a tube of light filled with stars that looks, for all the world to me, like a Star Trek transporter beam. And in fact, on my blog on williamhenry.net, you can go see this painting by Hieronymus Bosch, a Cathar-inspired painting of this column of glory. And you see this Cathar soul who has transfigured himself into a being of light ascending through the starry realms in this channel or portal of light. And so that was one of the most important things that I learned there, was that there's this whole missing piece in the Cathar story about their belief in these, what we would today call stargates, or what they refer to as channels of light or portals of light.
Interesting. Well, then we'll talk about that a little bit, because I enjoyed your lecture on DVD about wormholes and whether or not the ancient Egyptians or early Christians or anybody else would have had access to these parallel universes, these wormholes, this spiritual alchemy of which you speak. And we'll explore that coming up next hour with William Henry on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.